This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. James Joseph grew up in the heart of Klan country in the 1940s and 50s. Appaloosas, Louisiana was the state headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan, and he vividly remembers Klan marches down the street to city courthouse. Even with their hoods on, he recognized some of the men as his bosses from his day job picking cotton. And he vowed that one day he would earn the respect of those white men. And years later, as the first American ambassador to present his credentials to Nelson Mandela, he had achieved his goal and then some. James Joseph is professor emeritus at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy, and he joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Delighted to be with you on this beautiful North Carolina day.
Well, it's good to have you here and in the state. I know you spend some of your time still in Cape Town. You go back to South Africa frequently, right?
For the last 17 years, my wife and I have lived either full or part-time in Cape Town, South Africa.
It's interesting. We talked about you being named ambassador to South Africa during the Clinton administration, but your involvement in the anti-apartheid movement goes back far. I mean, it wasn't as though you were selected out of a pool. You were somebody who was deeply involved in that movement.
First visit to South Africa was in 1974. I went as an anti-apartheid activist and got into all sorts of trouble and had to leave the country prematurely.
You were getting in plenty of trouble here in the decade earlier, too. It's not like you had to go too far to find that kind of trouble.
Yes. In 1963, I helped organize and serve as co-chair of the local civil rights movement in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Tuscaloosa, Alabama, 1963. Yeah, so tell us about that. And first of all, how did you get involved in that and set the scene for us? What was happening in Tuscaloosa?
Well, I had been in graduate school at Yale and leading demonstrations on the New Haven Green, and that was kind of plastic and cosmetic, but I wanted to return south. I had been born in Louisiana, and I decided that I'd go to Alabama, and not to take on George Wallace, but despite of George Wallace. And so I went to teach at Stillman College in Tuscaloosa, ostensibly. I went to get involved in the movement because Montgomery had already happened, Birmingham had already happened, but nothing had happened in Tuscaloosa because it was the national headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan. And so after some advocacy and pushing and pulling and persuading a few people that the time had come to start a movement in Tuscaloosa, we organized a movement.
Tell us about the movement and about that organization, because as you said, I mean, that was the national headquarters of the Klan. I would think that it would be a difficult sell to convince people there that the time had come for them to undo segregation.
Well, it started when I was able to get three local ministers to sign a statement, a petition, or what in those days we called a demand, that the colored and white signs be removed from the county courthouse building under construction. And we got so much publicity, and we had not decided what we would do. We just wrote this letter. And we were on television, and people were speculating about who we were. And we got together again and said, look, we ought to do something. And we called a meeting at a historic Baptist church, and the turnout was incredible. The church was full, people standing in the parking lots, all wanting to know who we were, because none of us had been born there. And from that, we decided to form the movement. Martin Luther King came to join us at our first mass meeting, and we were off and running.
So you see, you were outside agitators.
That's what they called us, yeah. But I was born in Louisiana, and I don't know that makes me an outside in Alabama.
No, and in fact, you were. It was Appaloosas, Alabama, right, which was the state headquarters for the Klan.
Appaloosas,
yeah.
Louisiana. Yeah. I was born at the state, in the community that was the state headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan. My first job after graduate school was in a community that was the national headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, tell us about growing up in Appaloosas.
Well, it was a time of segregation and intentional underdevelopment of black people. My mother made it clear to me that I'd have to be twice as good as any white person in order to have half a chance. So from the very beginning, I made this commitment to excellence, to prove that my mother was right. And at that point, I didn't have the chance, but she always said, prepare, and your time will come. We studied in segregated schools. As a matter of fact, the school in which I studied had been decided that it was not fit for white students, and so they gave it to us, and we studied from books that was no longer fit for white students. But many of the people who were in the school with me eventually saved the city from collapse. My brother became the mayor at a time when of transition, and they were very much in need of new leadership, and he turned the city around. And many of those folks went on to do things of major significance.
Well, tell us more about it. So then from Opelousas, Louisiana, to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, again, I want to get the picture of a city or a town, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, under siege. I mean, in a sense, this sort of terrorist network of Klan activity keeps people from asking for their rights. And then you get this church full of folks showing up when outsiders say, take those signs down. Did it surprise you to see all those people at that church saying,
oh, absolutely. I had no idea that we'd get the kind of response we did. And the first march was an interesting one because we marched from this Baptist church downtown to the courthouse. The three other ministers and I, who were now the sort of executive committee, we were originally it, but now we had a following. And we decided that once we got in front of the courthouse, we would walk up and read a statement. When we got to the courthouse, we had state troopers waiting for us with billy clubs, and behind us were Klansmen with baseball bats. And as we turned to read the statement, the folks of the billy clubs descended on us with cattle prongs and drove us into the Klansmen with the baseball bats. That's how it was in those days.
And I'm guessing they didn't intervene to stop the violence.
No, they did not.
So what effect does this have? Again, this reinforces everybody's worst fear. Klan is in control of this place. Don't try it. And now you've sort of publicly, you know, proved the point. What was the follow up?
Well, I must say that the core of our group were the students at Stillman College. Oh. We turned them out on the day of the big demonstration. They were having chapel, and I asked for a moment at the chapel service to make an announcement. And I got up front, and I said to the students, I would like for you to go back to your rooms and get your toothbrushes and anything else you think you need to spend a night in jail. And I made an emotional plea, and when I walked out, most of the students in that building walked out with me. And some stopped at the dormitory, but most just continued. That was the way we started it.
It's interesting to consider where this determination came from. You watched growing up Klan marches in your own town, and hoods or not, you recognized some of the men under those hoods, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was growing up and in the summers, there were no jobs for black teenagers. And early on, I used to stand on the street corner early in the morning waiting for the truck to come by and take people to cotton farms where they picked cotton. And some of the people for whom I picked cotton, I recognized that they were those people marching with sheets in the evening.
And that's when you sort of made up your mind that you would come back. Is that true? You sort of made up your mind right then and there that you were going to come
back?
Well,
I used to, at break time for lunch, I used to lie under the wagon dreaming of a day when I would come back and I would get adulation and respect of those very same people. And one day I did. The governor hosted a celebration when I was appointed by Jimmy Carter as Deputy Secretary of the Interior. I went back and he gave me a state honor, and many of those people were there.
It must have been a great moment. Did you? How about any of your former bosses? They may have been long gone. Do you think
Well, I didn't recognize any of them.
And as if you didn't have enough trouble, so then you actually go to South Africa and get involved in demonstrations. Not just a call for divestment here in the United States, but you actually went to South Africa and got involved in demonstrations.
Yeah, in 1974, I decided to go to South Africa to see and hear and learn for myself how the people inside South Africa were thinking about what kind of support we could provide from outside. And I arrived, and I was at that time a senior officer of a major multinational corporation, and they allowed me to come in because they thought that the company was considering an investment. And actually, the company had been invited to develop engine or develop a distribution point there. And so they gave me the freedom of the country, which is something blacks didn't have in that time. But while I was there, I was invited to speak to a meeting in which it was a majority blacks, and I talked about black power and economic development. And I had a picture taken under a sign that said, whites only, no dogs allowed. And the next day, that picture was on the front page of all the major papers with a caption underneath saying that black American says his dignity insulted. Well, that night, and they also identified what I had said at this meeting and where I was staying. And all night long, I got threatening calls, and those threats became so credible that I left South Africa within the next 2 days.
On the state of things today, James Joseph, Professor Emeritus at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke. Just ahead, more of the civil rights movement and the career of James Joseph on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. I'm talking with James Joseph today. He's a professor emeritus at the Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy, was ambassador to South Africa. You talked about being in South Africa in the 1970s. You were working for Cummins Engine, a diesel engine maker, and you were there for the company, but then you made this Black Power speech. It did not endear you to the local officials there, and you left and you fled. What did Cummins say about all of this?
Well, when I made that Black Power speech, I might add that I described the country as a pigmentocracy. And, of course, it was obvious because the rights and privileges were portions in accordance with the pigmentation of the skin. Mm-hmm. But the South Africans seems to take real they were insulted by my describing a pigmentocracy as a pigmentocracy. But so when I returned home and I returned to Cummins Engine Company, where I was an officer, the South African ambassador called the chairman of my board and said that I had been a disgrace to the company. And the chairman's response was, no, he wasn't. As a matter of fact, we are real proud of him. And he is an asset not only to the company but the country. And so they thought that they could scare him into firing me. But I took that risk, as I often did, for the things I believed in. But I knew that J. Owen Miller, who Martin Luther King had called the most progressive businessman in the United States, was not about to fire me. As a matter of fact, he liked it very much. And later on, once in my career, when I was president of Council on Foundations, I invited him to speak at a conference. And I was complaining about some of the things. And he says, you know, Jim, I think you're becoming too conservative. We better bring you back to Columbus, Indiana.
We should really stop and note this, because this is 1974 you're talking about? This is an American corporation that has appointed an African-American as one of its executives in the 70s and is proud of the fact that they're making trouble in a place they'd like to do business. This did cut against the grain,
yeah,
didn't it?
As early as 1970, I was a senior officer of the company that was the leading manufacturer of diesel engines in the world. That in itself was unique. I had come there originally to organize and develop the philanthropy of the family that owned the company, but the company went public And Owen Miller asked me to go into the company to institutionalize the values that were informal. They were basically his values. And so I left the foundation and went into the company and began to institutionalize the values. As a matter of fact, someone wrote a few years later that I was the first ethics officer in a multinational company.
Wow. We could use a few more. We could use that. Let's talk about your education now after you leave. You did your undergraduate work at Southern University, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Tell us about that, why you chose to go
those,
there.
Well, those were the days of segregation, and I would have gone to Louisiana State University, except that it was not open to blacks. And in those days, we thought Southern was just as good, but it was necessarily a first step. I mean, I knew I was going to go beyond Southern, but I had to start somewhere. And we had some of the best professors in the world. Southern University at that time was the largest black university in the United States, and our professors had graduated from the best universities in the East and the Northwest, et cetera. And the students came from all over. So I was, pleased to be there, but I knew that I was going to go on to graduate school somewhere else.
What were you planning to do?
Well, that's interesting. My father was a Baptist minister, and very early in my life, when I started winning oratorical contests and doing that sort of thing, they said, "You're going to be a preacher like your father." And my father really hoped that I would be a preacher like him, but I was looking for other options, and so I was in the ROTC, and so I went into the military as an officer And actually, I was a commander of a detachment in an infantry brigade, a medical detachment, no less. And I considered that because that at that time was a place where blacks with ambition and blacks with ability could succeed. But I only considered it for a fleeting moment.
A career in medicine?
No. I was in the medical... I was actually majoring in political science, but I did not want to get in combat. I really got into the ROTC because it provided a subsidy, and I needed the subsidy.
Yeah.
And then at my last year, I began to think, my God, I'm going to have to go to active duty. And so I did not feel that I would be do well in a combat unit. So
the Vietnam War is on, right? I mean,
that was after the Vietnam War.
Okay.
After the Vietnam War, the Korean War came. I mean, the Vietnamese War became shortly afterwards. But I applied for the medical service, which was an administrative officer, not a medical officer. And my friends in pre-med didn't get it, but I did. And I did because I did not want to fight. And at that time, not that I was totally committed to nonviolence, but my whole way of thinking and way of being had sort of changed from the time I had enrolled in ROTC and the time I graduated in ROTC. So I wanted to do something else other than be engaged in a combat unit. So they assigned me to a combat unit as the medical detachment for the combat unit.
I see.
So that there it was.
Was it? What was it like for you? Now you're an officer, so you're in a position where, you have white enlisted men saluting you.
Not only white enlisted men, but white officers. I had several officers who had graduated from West Point who were working for me. And that advice from my mother that you had to be twice as good in order to have half a chance served me well. I continued to be driven by this desire for excellence in everything I did. And my wife sometimes tells me I don't need to be so driven anymore.
Well, it's a good habit, but no doubt about that. You went to Yale Divinity School, and so Divinity School suggests that you still had a little bit of your father's voice in your ear.
When I finished my term in the military, I was trying to decide what to do. I considered law school, and I had met a young man who was a student at Yale Divinity School when I was an undergraduate. I went to a national conference, and he was one of the speakers. And I liked what he had to say, and I queried him about what it means to study in a place like Yale Divinity School. And I began to realize they were interested in the life of the mind. And this was not just a place where you went to learn biblical history and biblical theology. It induced you to think about what all this means in the context in which all this took place. And as I thought about it, I said, I think what I really want to do now is just go to some place that I can read the great literature and some place where I could think critically about issues and the world. But I had this commitment that I knew that eventually I wanted to work with people and that I wanted to work for equality and social justice. And so I visited Yale, and I went to the Divinity School, and again, I love the people I met. And so one day, a bright sunny day in August in New Haven, I ended up at Yale Divinity School.
I happen to think that critical thinking and faith are quite compatible. On the other hand, it can also bring people who have not been maybe engaged in that sort of thought, this life of the mind, to a crisis point in their lives. Did that happen to you?
Yeah, well, I had a spiritual journey at Yale, and I went from what basically was an age of faith to an age of belief that was based on something more substantive than my Sunday school stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wanted to do. But I also went through another third stage, which I probably call the age of the spirit, where I was trying to find meaning and mystery and understand the awesomeness of creation and that sort of thing. And so I had started as a Baptist, and I realized that I didn't fit there anymore theologically, though my father was still a Baptist minister. And so I ended up joining what was the Congregational Church then, the United Church of Christ now, because I found that theologically I had more in affinity, because the Christology of the Congregationalists went from almost a Baptist Christology to a Unitarian, and you were accepted in that spectrum, anywhere in that spectrum.
It's Christology, meaning sort of where we put Christ on
yes.
the spectrum of divinity, and it becomes a kind of a deep theological question, but it can divide a lot of people. You made this decision, and that is when, and we've talked about your activities in Tuscaloosa, but that's when you made your decision to come back south, right?
Yes, that's when I made the decision. But I didn't last too long. I saw too many people who had been on the front line too long and needed renewal. And after a year in Alabama, we were very successful. We desegregated the local facilities. The local people were taking ownership of the movement. And I realized that the constant clashes with the Klan, listening to George Wallace every day, was creating a kind of rage that was unsettling. And I decided to accept an offer to go to the Claremont Colleges to work as an associate chaplain. Within 6 months after I was in Claremont, I was head of the Southern California Committee Against the Vietnam War, and I was getting the same kind of threats I'd been getting in Alabama.
Well, that too is – well, first of all, I want to pursue that. The idea that you felt this rage welling up in you and understood it to be destructive, that you needed to do something.
Right, right. And I saw too many of my friends who were burnt out for working 24 hours a day. And not just working, but the clashes with the Klan, the threats from people, going home and wondering whether someone is inside waiting for you. And even though I was promoting nonviolence, I came home one day in Tuscaloosa and my next-door neighbor was sitting in his front yard with a shotgun across his legs, protecting the front entrance to my house. And I realized that at that point, nonviolence was not a total life commitment. It was a strategy that we hoped would be effective.
All right. Well, and not everybody on the other side embraced the same theories.
I went to Claremont, I stayed there much longer. As a matter of fact, I left a couple times and kept coming back until I was the chaplain of the Claremont Colleges, and I had a big staff serving 5 undergraduate colleges and a graduate school. And I was also on the faculty of the Graduate School of Theology then.
It's interesting that you would then take on the Vietnam War as well. This was something, I mean, you talked about the threats, but also from the point of view and the vantage point of the civil rights struggle, Martin Luther King received a lot of criticism from inside the movement for opening up the movement to include
the
Vietnam War. Why did you decide to make that part of your...
Well, I always felt that I was a part of two great movements, the civil rights movement and the liberation movement in Southern Africa. And so I was already beginning to move toward doing things to against apartheid and joining the anti-apartheid movement. But I came to realize more generally that I should be a part of the total human rights movement rather than just the civil rights movement. And so I got involved in all sorts of things, the Latina farm workers movement, the Native American movement, and I had moved from my civil rights days to human rights days, and the stage in California was set for that. I spoke all around the state with a folk singer named Clive Hangin. He'd sing, and I would speak, and I just sort of got elevated to the point where I was being asked to take positions and to do things about other movements as well.
Well, certainly Dr. King saw those all as united as well. I mean, it's fascinating to me as we sort of contemplate the legacy of Nelson Mandela to think about Dr. King's speech in 1957, Birth of a New Nation, a speech that he gives about the rise of Kwame Nkrumah as the president of Ghana over and the end of British rule there. This is 1957. Martin Luther King had been there, and he talks about a new nation. And the vision he creates is that this is a worldwide struggle. We're all in it together, and there's hope, and things can change. And yet if you think about the struggles for Ghana and for South Africa, even in the post-colonial times, in many ways they're all struggling, and we are all struggling with many of the same things that Dr. King talked about in 1957.
Yes, I took this notion of establishing justice to be a universal thing rather than simply domestic. And I realized that our struggles were a part of each other. And we were facing similar impediments and barriers. And we were becoming interdependent as a world. And so my concerns did not stop at the boundaries of the United States.
When you talked about this as ambassador, tell us about your about meeting Nelson Mandela and the kinds of conversations you had. I would think that if you had time to talk, you probably had a lot to talk about.
Yes, there is a lot. I consider myself fortunate to have been born in the 20th century because I had an opportunity to work with Nelson Mandela. And I feel the same way about J. Owen Miller, who many people have not heard about, but who was my mentor and who was an advisor to both Kennedy and Johnson on civil rights. But I first met Nelson Mandela in Washington, D.C., when I shared the dais with him to host him for his first meeting in the first visit to the United States. But ironically, 2 months earlier, I had been standing outside of Parliament in Cape Town with a Free Mandela sign when the clerk announced that Nelson Mandela would be set free. And so I met him in Washington, and then again a couple years later I took a delegation of foundation executives to South Africa and had dinner with Mandela and even co-hosted a press conference with him. That in itself is a long story I won't get into. But and then I saw him again at least another time before I was appointed ambassador. So by the time I arrived as ambassador, I not only knew him, but I had met many of the leaders in exile and even some of the people inside South Africa who became a part of the new government. So when President Clinton asked me to become his ambassador to South Africa, and he told me to get back to him later, I was pondering it, and because I was at a point in my career, I wasn't sure I wanted to leave the United States. And my kid said to me, "Now, Dad, you can't be serious. I mean, this is where your life has been leading." And so I agreed to be the United States ambassador to South Africa.
Did you ever have a chance to sit down and compare notes?
When I presented my credentials to Mr. Mandela, this is a day of ritual, pomp, and circumstances. And I said, Mr. Mandela, I have come to exchange my Free Mandela sign for my credentials as the United States Ambassador. As I wrote recently in an op-ed, he loved it. And then he invited my wife and I to have tea with him. We were sitting there thinking, well, it'd be a great idea to ask him to take a picture with us. And just as the time we sort of looked at each other and realized that this was maybe the time to do it, Nelson Mandela looked at me and he said, Mr. Ambassador, would you do me the honor of taking your picture with me? That's the measure of the man. He was disarming and charming, but he was real.
On the State of Things today, talking with James Joseph, Professor Emeritus at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University, former ambassador to South Africa, and also a career in philanthropy. We haven't talked about that yet, so after the break, we'll come back and do just that. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with James Joseph today, Professor Emeritus at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy, former ambassador to South Africa. And actually, you worked with four different presidents. That was the first was Jimmy Carter. What were you doing for Jimmy Carter?
I was the Undersecretary of the Interior, the Deputy Secretary, and I worked with Jimmy Carter for 4 years. In that capacity, I had oversight of the American territories. I had oversight of Native American, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is not one of my most glorious assignments because I didn't accomplish much for a variety of reasons, but also had natural resource responsibilities and many others.
You were in a plane crash as a result of while you were on the job.
Yes. As part of my responsibilities for the territories, I went out to the South Pacific to visit many of these territories that had never been visited by anyone of my rank in government but had been very much neglected, and we were their trustee. And at that particular time, the people of Bikini, who had been removed from the island of Bikini because of atomic testing, and the soil was contaminated, the coconuts were contaminated. They've been living on this alternate island for a number of years, and they petitioned me to allow them to return to Bikini to die in the land of their ancestors. After visiting Bikini, I decided to visit 14 other islands to see how the people were living and what we could do to improve their condition. On a flight from Guam headed to Yap, I was on a plane that crashed in the Pacific Ocean, and I spent 4 hours on a life raft and was finally rescued.
How many others were rescued, and were there,
There were 30 people on the plane. I was headed to Yap to dedicate a health center, and I had a military and Navy band with me, a small Navy band. And so there were 30 of us, and two people did not survive, and about half of the people were pretty seriously injured but recovered.
Did you think you were going to survive?
I did from the very moment I knew we were going to crash. People find that difficult to understand, but somehow I never thought that I might not survive. I just tried to remember what I had to do to survive.
Mm. Tell us about the mission again. You recommended against the return to Bikini because the soil was far too contaminated.
Yes. I went and I met with the people of Bikini, all of the people on one island, and it was a three-hour meeting where they told me what they thought of the United States, none of which I had responsibility for, but I was the only representative of the U.S. government at that level that ever met. And they insisted that we allow them to return. I thought about this, and this is one of the great moral dilemmas in my career, and I talk and write often about dealing with moral dilemmas. But I decided that the young people did not vote, and they were going to be doomed to an early death. And I turned down their recommendation. However, I made certain that we built a school on that island, that we built a health center on that island, and that we escalated the cleanup of Bikini. And in a few years, they were able to return to Bikini.
Because of the cleanup.
Because of the cleanup.
You talk about that. Your work really, you find yourself over and over again involved in this, what I would call the legacy of colonialism, that every time it rears its head, it has these consequences that put the next generation in these moral dilemma. And as you said, I didn't do it. I'm not responsible for it. But because of the way colonialism works, people continue to suffer, and it's the next generation that's asked to respond.
Yes, yes, yes. And I don't think many Americans understand that the best way to demonstrate the efficacy of our democracy to critics abroad is to demonstrate that it can work equitably for all of our citizens at home. And so unless we begin to establish justice and to promote the general welfare in a more significant way here, we lose credibility abroad.
I know you've been to the Moral Monday protests, and you obviously were involved in some pretty serious protests throughout your life. Tell us how you feel about those and where you think they might lead.
Well, I think we have to have multifaceted responses to the predicament in which many Americans find themselves now because of impediments created by other Americans. And I think the Moral Monday is one way of doing that. As a matter of fact, my wife and I have joined the Moral Monday. And so in North Carolina, we have to use every means that are available to us to let people know that this state is changing. I came to North Carolina. I had known Terry Sanford. I served on a commission he chaired when I lived in Washington, and I served on a board with him. And he was one of the reasons I came here. And I've had to sit and watch and now get involved as people are dismantling the legacy of Terry Sanford.
You know, you talk about that. I mentioned that speech that Dr. King gave in 1957. It was immediately after the success of the Montgomery bus boycott. The buses had become desegregated. In the speech, he says, this is not the end. The desegregation of these buses isn't it. And people of privilege will not give up their privilege on their own. We must act over time. And that was the thrust of the speech in 57. And here we are in 2013. And you say, in a sense, do you feel the clock has been rolled back since then?
Well, you know, I think when I reflect on my experience, it seemed to me that in the 60s, we had a revolution of the underprivileged. And we've been seeing a counter-revolution of the privileged. And the next revolution has got to involve the underprivileged and some of the privileged who are capable of recognizing that this, too, is in their self-interest. This is not just a moral imperative. It is self-interest that we are talking about.
How are those some of the privileged? What's their interest in this and becoming involved? How do you see it?
Well, you know, there was a book written recently in which it reported on an international study of countries around the world. And what they found was that in countries that were more equal, there was likely to be more tranquility. And the quality of life was better. I think we've got to change the discourse from simply promoting change as a moral imperative to promoting it as enlightened self-interest. And we've got to use a different vocabulary and tell a different narrative about why this is critical to everyone.
Well, and again, that raises so many questions about what it means to be doing better or prospering in a country. Latest IMF report on South Africa. South Africa has high unemployment, 25% unemployment rate. Growth is slowing down. And by all of the metrics of globalized, the global economy, it's not doing as well as it had been. And their suggestion is to end unions. It's everything that would help those underprivileged and working classes needs to be dismantled, according to the IMF, to promote economic growth. If they're right, does that mean that economic growth is sort of incompatible with the kind of equality and tranquility you're talking about?
Well, the South Africans have to find their own way, and that's difficult in an interdependent world economy. And the IMF's suggesting things that would benefit those who are already doing well. And so the concern is with the gross domestic product and that grows, but it's not a concern about how that is distributed. And the South Africans have to develop a model that is their own model Mr. Mandela was concerned about some of the things that IMF recommended to developing nations, that it wasn't touching the poorest of the poor. And so I think they are working on that. And when you consider they've only been a democracy for less than 20 years, I'm very optimistic about the future. And I think they will get it right. I didn't expect that I would see in my lifetime the end of the apartheid state, and I did. I didn't think I'd ever see Mandela become president, and I did. So I think they'll get it right, and they will go through ups and downs. And in some ways, they're going through the downs now.
You have worked for four presidents. We've talked about two, Clinton and Carter. You worked for two Republicans as well, Ronald Reagan and the first Bush. Tell us about what you did in the Reagan administration.
Well, I was in senior executive positions in the Clinton and the Carter administration. And the Reagan administration, I served on two commissions in senior positions in those commissions. I was vice chair of George Bush's Points of Light Foundation and an incorporating director. And I might add that the first George Bush was the only one of the four presidents to invite me to lunch in the family quarters at the White House, to invite me to Camp David and that sort of thing. Friends thought he was trying to convert me to being a Republican, but I was glad for the interaction because I believed in what he was saying about voluntarism and philanthropy. Under Ronald Reagan, I served as chair of the Commission on the Northern Marianas that had been created by Congress to make recommendations on what policies should apply as they became a commonwealth. I might add that as I had that service under him, somebody in his administration recognized that we sometime met in Hawaii and that sort of thing. And just as I was ready to sign the final report, I was removed from the commission and somebody else signed the report. I was also appointed by Ronald Reagan on the advisory committee to the Agency for International Development. We got in a policy discussion where I disagreed strongly with the Reagan administration, and next thing I knew, I wasn't on that commission either.
What was that? What was that debate about?
It was a debate about the Caribbean Initiative, and they wanted us as a commission to take a policy position. And my point was that we were an advisory commission and having to do with development, and we ought not to be getting involved in taking policy positions.
Let's talk about that first Bush administration, 1,000 Points of Light, their initiative to really harness the power of nonprofits and churches to meet some of the social needs that that government was meeting up until that time. Of course, government spending under attack, and this would be a way for nonprofits and philanthropy to take over. You say he was sincere in that because, of course, the criticism is it won't be enough, and if it falls short, nobody's responsible. There's no accountability for whether or not those needs go met.
Well, I always felt I served as president of the Council on Foundation and chief executive officer for 14 years, and I was appointed by Bush to this because of the position I held. He couldn't have a Points of Light Foundation without having the president of the Council on Foundation or some such person on the commission, and it was a bipartisan commission, and I served on it. But I always emphasize not just the potential of voluntarism and philanthropy, but the limits. And many of the people around him were strong advocates for voluntarism, but they saw it as an alternative to the responsibility of government. And also their notion of voluntarism was sometime what people do with their extra time. And I like to point out that the biggest movement of voluntarism in the United States was the Civil Rights Movement. And it was a movement for social change rather than one that sought to provide social service.
You actually served on the successor to the North Carolina Fund, going back to Terry Sanford. And there again, that was a philanthropic idea, a philanthropic network that was based on activism and leadership, right?
Oh, that's right. I served as chair of the board of MDC for a number of years, and I was pleased to do that. And it was the legacy of Terry Sanford and the North Carolina Fund. And they were touching all of the right issues and doing all of the right things. You see, some nonprofit organizations do a good job in ameliorating the consequences of a problem. and others do a good job in trying to eliminate the cause. And so I always found myself in the one that was cause-oriented, eliminating the cause. And MDC was demonstrating and incubating projects that got at the cause of an issue rather than simply ameliorated the consequences.
Are we seeing more of that today now that we see the government pulling out and pulling back so far in all of its responsibilities, now even public education, pulling back from that? Are people taking up the cause and coming up with creative ways, or are we left back?
There are still some very good people who are, but far too many people don't recognize that they really aren't touching the problem, and that to get involved in the problem is risky, and it also sometimes dangerous professionally. And so people would much rather get involved in the organizations that are charity organizations rather than the ones that are social change organizations. And my personal philanthropy is directed to mostly the latter. My personal time is directed to ones that are social change as well. And that's one of the issues I had when I was president of the Council on Foundations. I had 2,000 of the largest foundations, and they came from five continents as well as the United States. And I always tried to make that distinction between charity and strategic philanthropy. And it's wonderful to see a man with a broken leg and to want to do something about it. But if you see several people with broken legs, then you want to know what's caused that. I like to use the biblical story of the Samaritan. He was traveling along the road, and he saw this man beaten by the side of the road, and he stopped to help, and that was wonderful. But suppose he traveled that road every day, and for a week he found somebody beaten on the side of the road in the same spot. He'd somehow have to ask, why is this so? And then he would ask the public policy question, who has responsibility for policing the road? I am always asking who has responsibility for policing the road.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending your time with us and sharing your thoughts. James Joseph, Professor Emeritus at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Wonderful to talk with you. So nice to meet you.
So delighted to be with you.
That's our program for today. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. Our website, stateofthings.org. Our producers, Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is the news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.